You're listening to Practically Ideal.
You gotta be practically ideal instead of just ideal.
Ready for some podcasting.
Oh, Logan, you got any better, man?
All work and no play.
We're now live, and this is Practically Culture, a podcast devoted to TV, movies, and other pop culture. I'm your host, Logan Bowe, podcasting from Brooklyn. I'm joined by the one, the only Bob Caswell in the Bay Area. How are you, Bob?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, making it. You know me.
Awesome.
Welcome to the new and improved podcast. We've got another great show today with a full review of Closed Circuit, TV recaps of Breaking Bad on the Bridge, final summer power rankings, mini reviews, and weekend picks. It's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. Let's rock. Oh man, it is good to be back. You look great, Bob, as we video cast this show live as a Google Plus Hangout on air. We're recording on Labor Day, so please excuse the scruffy holiday look. I'm usually so clean cut after all.
Right, of course.
Ready to get to it?
Let's do it.
Closed Circuit. A high-profile terrorism case unexpectedly binds together two ex-lovers on the defense team, testing the limits of their loyalties and placing their lives in jeopardy. Starring Eric Bana, who's pretty well known, and Rebecca Hall, who, to refresh your memory, was the Vicky in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. She shows up in Iron Man 3. To be honest, she does such a good American, I didn't even realize she was English. Directed by John Crowley. Who's done things I've never heard of. Boy A, anyone? Intermission? I don't know. And written by Stephen Knight, who did Eastern Promises. Do you have a mini review for us, Bob?
Yes. Closed Circuit. I gave this movie a 3.5 out of 5. Had me at international suspense thriller, in quotes, but had a hard time keeping me with the convoluted approach of its villainous characters. That said, enjoyable performances and interesting subject matter. Yeah, 3.5 out of 5. How about you?
Here's my mini review. I was worried it would be boring, which it thankfully wasn't. And I'm not usually a plot hole stickler, but a suspense thriller pretty much needs its plot to be solid and tight, and this one wasn't. Bana's and Hall's chemistry could only make up for so many moments of confusion. 3 out of 5.
Ah, you're less forgiving than I was, but it seems like we had the same problem.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned last week that the previews looked dreadfully dull, so I was skeptical going into Closed Circuit. And it's weird, right after I saw it, I was happy that it wasn't nearly as boring as I thought. Since it exceeded my expectations, it made me like it. But once I sat down and started putting some notes together for my review, started thinking about it, the more I realized how flawed Closed Circuit was.
Yeah, it really was. I don't know where to start here. I think, well, in my mini review, I alluded to this. The quote-unquote bad guys in the movie, which I guess is the MI5, you know, the equivalent of, what is that, the CIA, the NSA, a combination in England?
At one point, they made a distinction between MI5 and MI6, like I was supposed to know what that was, and me being an American, I'm like, I don't know the difference there.
It's something like that, though. Yeah, I noticed that, too. I'm like, oh, the number changed in the acronym. It's a different team. Should I know that? Is one, like, James Bond level and one's less James Bond level? That's as far as I went.
But something like that, CIA, NSA, FBI, something like that.
Right, so the interesting thing is that, you know, we're supposed to get this feeling that you're constantly being watched or being managed if you are important to these agencies, the British version of, you know, what happens in the U.S. And I got that feeling a little bit, but as the movie went along further and further, I got it less and less because when they kind of pulled back the curtain and they showed some of the people pulling the levers of these top secret agencies, it just didn't come across as believable with the two to three characters that were on that side. And then one other quick thing, the other problem, which I'm sure we'll get into, is that you just couldn't keep track of when they wanted to eliminate somebody, because that was the solution, versus do something else. Like, for being these top secret government agencies, they're really fickle on their approach.
Yeah, sure. So hitting back on one thing you just mentioned, so the movie is called Closed Circuit, right? And they make a big deal about how people are always being watched. But in the second half of the movie, sometimes, somehow they're able to avoid cameras pretty much whenever they need to. I mean, the government knows every time Martin Rose, played by Eric Bana, needs a taxi in the first half. But in the second half, they can't find him for the life of them.
Right. And for being a closed circuit, it totally, like, sidesteps the internet. Like, that's just missing in action in the movie. It's all about, like, old school cameras on blocked corners. Yeah, it felt very, like, 80s or 90s-esque or something. I mean, and it worked in a way, except for that the internet is such a predominant part of everyday life that that's the part that didn't work. And I was like, wait, is this a new movie or an old one?
Yeah, right. It could have been written 15 years ago, 20 years ago, easy, it seems like. And then the other thing you mentioned as far as the what I'm going to call the scope of the conspiracy and how coherent it was at different times. For me, what I think is similar to that but was a disappointment for me was how much this conspiracy seems to permeate through the government, how deep it went. I was hoping for, like, a little more gray area in the principles that the various people involved had. You know, a little bit of understandable motivation to the bad guys, even if they were, like, taking things too far. But, you know, not really. They were just pretty much bad. And the number of people who went along with the evil plot in the government without questioning was just disappointing, pointing to me as someone who wants a little more ambiguity in my political thrillers.
I totally agree with you. There was, for a while, you were a little unclear of who was good and who was bad, and then they do reveals on different characters, and there's, like, no nuance. It's just, like, they're all pawns of the government. They're either sold out or they're, like, freedom fighters, and there's no real in-between.
I didn't hate everything, though. I mean, I feel like we should maybe touch on a couple of good things.
Definitely.
But so to start with some of the good, I think the good starts with the acting. I loved Eric Bana. I loved Rebecca Hall. Right from the beginning, you know, when Hall, as special advocate Claudia Simmons Howe, visits the newly appointed defense attorney Martin Rose, played by Eric Bana, we just see the tension and get that they have history immediately. You know, supposedly they're not supposed to talk to each other because they have different important roles in the justice system. And right there they decide, you know, based on a lot of previous relationship, I guess, just to hide their history, and right from the get-go they're co-conspirators in a certain sense. And I think that's the best part of the movie, at least it was for me, seeing more and more of their relationship revealed, how they interact with each other in lots of different circumstances, like they've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, I also enjoyed some of the ensemble cast, like Jim Broadbent. And he'd give these awesome monologues over breakfast while he's, like, cutting his dinner or breakfast, you know, his French toast, and he's like, well, here's the thing. Takes a bite with his fork, and I think he's a great actor anyway. He works for me in most every role in every movie I've ever seen him in. But for being a non-nuanced, deliberately corrupt pencil pusher, I bought it with him way more than with a lot of the other characters who felt a little more over the top, especially like the characters that had to execute on the killings and randomly try to kill people but then not kill them. Those characters just didn't work nearly as well. But Jim Broadbent was great.
So I liked Kieran Hines. I mean, I think he was written in a little bit disappointing way, but I think he plays that kind of guy who's just sort of weird looking but confident, and I don't know how to describe him, but I always like a good Kieran Hines character.
Yeah, I agree. I could have used with some more nuance, but I did love his chipper attitude, and he played the part well of, you know, he's in the system, he's a government guy, but he's not boring, he's not just, I guess I don't want to give away too much, but he did a good job.
Yeah, the other one that I actually found myself enjoying, I didn't know him before, but Riz Ahmed, he pulls off that polite and helpful secret agent who's obviously hiding something more sinister, but he doesn't really let you know what it is up front.
Yeah, see, now he's the character, one of the characters I was referring to, that when he has to do his dirty work, it felt very forced. There are a couple of scenes where he does the Hollywood, I'm going to start killing you, and while I'm trying to kill you, I will explain the plot, give you a monologue, you know, during my evil scene. He just didn't work as well for me.
That's fair. I guess I liked him more on those early scenes when he's delivering the documents or explaining to Claudia how things are going to have to go. And just like Claudia, you can see instantly that, you know, he's doing his job, he's being very helpful, but he's also hiding something. And I thought at those moments, he was pretty good.
Sure, yeah. And this does have a little bit of the, It started better than it ends. It's kind of one of those movies. Not extremely so. It's pretty consistent, but I still would go with the first half being better than the second half. Would you say the same?
Oh, yeah. One of the things I liked as, you know, an American lawyer was getting an up-close glimpse at the legal system in the UK. A lot's really similar, but they have a lot of details that are different. For example, those silly wigs and those uncomfortable-looking courtrooms or little details like the ribbons on the sealed documents. And all that was pretty cool. And I also like the reminder how the war on terrorism leads to giving up civil liberties if we're not careful. And I think of that as such an American thing we're wrestling with. But sometimes I forget that other countries have the exact same thing. And that I felt like it was more of a pressing issue in the first half before it got sort of exaggerated out of proportion in the second half.
Yeah, totally agree. That was the part of the premise that really kind of grabs you as it starts, and then it sort of slowly slides away as it becomes more about the specifics of the situation and the overarching message is a little more heavy-handed by the end. You know, one person we didn't talk about is Julia Stiles. What did you think of her appearance? She doesn't have a huge role. She plays a reporter, and she only gets a scene or two. But I'm a fan of Julia Stiles. I like her in a lot of stuff. I've seen her, you know, for the last 10, 15 years, but I felt like she didn't have much to go with in this one.
Yeah, I felt like there wasn't much there. I felt like if we just eliminated those scenes, the movie wouldn't have been basically any different, to be quite honest.
Right, yeah.
I have one thing now that we're probably getting close to the end of this review, and this is my biggest problem with it. I felt like the plot just had some gaping holes. There's just a lot not to like. So one of the major ones is when Martin Rose, Eric Bana, he figures out something important about the defendant, he decides immediately he's going to break his oath and tell Claudia. And in the very next breath he says, but don't do anything about this. It's like, wait, so why did you go out of your way to break the law to tell her, only to try and keep her from acting on this information? If you were smart, you'd keep it to yourself if you didn't want her to do anything, since it's against the law anyway. But no. He doesn't, and it turns out that the whole rest of the story pretty much depends on that blunder.
Yeah, there is that plot hole. I guess now that you frame it that way, I suppose it's starting to bother me even more. I guess the one that bothered me even more than that, though, was the fact that Claudia, as a character, and you see this in the previews, you know, they try to eliminate her, they being, you know, whichever government body that's trying to put a lid on this whole thing. But then when they are unsuccessful, then she's no longer needs to be eliminated soon after that scene. Or I don't know. There's just a lot of times where they switch their tactics. They're like, wow, we got to take this person out. Oh, never mind, not anymore. And the movie doesn't do a good job of showing you why the government acts in the way that they do to try to keep a lid on this whole thing. It just feels like sometimes they kill people, sometimes they don't. And it's more for the suspense of the act of the movie that we're in rather than like any sort of plot point.
Yeah, fair enough. So if I were to give my own final word, you know, like I say, the chemistry between the two leads kept me into the movie the whole time. And if maybe you can somehow turn your brain off and not think about the problems, you might like it a lot. Anyway, that's all I have to say. What's the final word? Wrap this up for us, Bob.
Yeah, I was definitely not bored. It's decent pacing. It's interesting subject matter. Performances are good. You suspend disbelief in some annoying ways, but overall, I still enjoyed it. So 3.5 out of 5. See it if you're interested in this kind of subject matter and you're okay with some of these flaws, but otherwise, it's pass. You could see other things that are better.
Right on. It's time for mini reviews, Bob. What do you have for us?
Okay, The Company You Keep. I gave The Company You Keep a 4 out of 5, and here's what I have to say about it. Robert Redford stars and directs this semi-political drama with great performances by a fantastic ensemble cast, perhaps a bit predictable and idealistic, but I'm happy to see Redford still putting out solid dialogue-heavy dramas. So, this movie actually came out, I think, back in April of this year, and so it was a quick-to-DVD release, or on-demand is how I saw it. Not a huge window in the theaters, and I don't think it did super well, which is too bad. It's not an amazing Oscar contender. It's just kind of one of these, like I said in the review, it's a solid drama, has a lot of dialogue, a lot of characters, Robert Redford, And let me just give a quick rundown of the cast. I have to like say it from a window, or you know, from a browser, because there's just so many people in this movie that I'm going to miss some. And this alone is reason enough to see this movie. So we've got Robert Redford, Shia LaBeouf, Susan Sarandon, Nick Nolte, Chris Cooper, Stanley Tucci, Richard Jenkins, Anna Kendrick, Terrence Howard, Britt Marling, Sam Elliott, and Stephen Root, who is Milton from Office Space. Just want to throw that in there. Oh. he's been in a lot of other things. But yeah, Britt Marling was a surprise. Well, everyone was a surprise. They just come on screen. They come in and out of scenes really well. I'm going to say that the performances were really well done. It was almost like a series of cameos, but each of them are slightly more than cameos. It's a fairly long movie. It's just over 2 hours, but it didn't feel boring or like it was too long, and all the characters got enough time to develop their point of view and their contribution to the story. So I really, really enjoyed the cast and all the performances and all the dialogue.
So I'm glad you singled out Britt Marling, too. I feel like we've sort of unofficially adopted her as someone we want to be a fan of. But we watched The East and mixed feelings about it, though we mostly liked it. I'm just curious. Tell me more about Britt Marling in the movie. What did you think?
She has a small-ish role, but it becomes bigger toward the end, I guess. She acts similarly to how we've seen her in some of these other movies. Notably what you just said, The East. She does a good job. You could consider her almost a love interest of Shia LaBeouf's character. And by the way, Shia LaBeouf is like one of the main... He and Robert Redford are kind of the two leads. Uh-huh. She does a really good job. It's right up her alley. This is the type of movie you could tell she would love to be in, because it kind of has the same vibe as The East, in the sense that it's about government corruption a little bit and how people deal with that in different ways over the years. And in fact, I didn't do a very good job of giving an overview of the plot. Basically, just really quickly, Robert Redford, he's a lawyer who's almost retired. He has a young daughter that she's like 10 or 11. And at the beginning, Susan Sarandon's character turns herself in for some event that happened 30 years ago that you're unclear how Robert Redford's character is tied to it. But then you sort of see it play out over the full 2 hours of the movie, all of his connections and this event in the past, how he was involved and why the law, the legal and police forces after him at this stage. And then he's sort of on the run. It's got a little bit of a fugitive feel. Anyway, it's a good movie. It's solid. My liberal tendencies sort of started to show through as I saw the movie, because there's some scenes where it was perhaps too idealistic and it really spoke to me, but I knew that it was kind of taking some shortcuts a little bit. But that notwithstanding, it was very enjoyable.
Cool. And you gave it 4 stars, right?
Yeah, 4 out of 5.
Cool. Well, the summer season is at an end, and it's time to close our famous pop culture power rankings for the summer, now that we've seen everything. So, Bob, give us your summer movie power rankings, your top 10 movies of the summer, going from 10 to 1.
Ooh, from 10 to 1. Okay, this is fun. okay, so at number 10, I've got The World's End, which I gave a 3.5 out of 5. We just reviewed this, I think, last week. Simon Pegg's action comedy. A lot of fun, but then towards the end, it didn't work out as well for me, and I think for you. But it made the list. It's number 10, so what do you say?
All right, yeah. I don't think of that as one of the best movies of the summer, but maybe number 10 is about right. Okay, cool. Next.
All right, number 9, The Wolverine, Hugh Jackman, starring and being the center of attention throughout this whole movie. I gave this one a 3.5 out of 5. I'm an X-Men fan. It wasn't it wasn't even close to the best X-Men movie. It's somewhere in the middle or even towards the lower half of X-Men movies, but not the worst of them either, and I quite enjoyed it for what it was. So it's number 9 on my list.
All right.
And let's see. Number 8, Coffee Town. Now, Coffee Town I also gave 3.5 out of 5. This is that one movie that I saw on demand. It was made by one of those humor websites, I think College Humor, and it stars the dude from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And
Dennis, right?
Yeah, Dennis.
His real name's Dennis, too, I think.
Is it? Okay. I thought this movie was pretty funny. It had good pacing. It wasn't too long. It was a lot of fun. It had some crude humor stuff that wasn't as funny and sort of ruined some of it in a way, and that's why I gave it a 3.5 out of 5, but ultimately a decent comedy.
And it was an on-demand release, right? Did it even come in theaters? I can't remember.
No, yeah, it didn't come in theaters. This was one of those new business model things, which actually kind of I like to support, and maybe that's playing into my ranking a little bit, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's number 8, 3.5 out of 5 for Coffeetown. Number 7. Okay, here's where, now this is interesting, starting at number 7 for me, this is where we break into the 4 out of 5 movies.
Oh, okay.
So this means, for those keeping score at home, which we all know you are, I give movies 4 out of 5 when I can recommend them with smaller caveats. Anything below a 4 out of 5 is like, I have to make more disclaimers, and if you see it, I can be like, well, I only gave it a 3.5. I mean, come on. But I feel bad if you watch a 4 out of 5 Bob movie and you totally hate it. That would make me feel bad.
Feel like that's an important update to our conversation last week about my movie ranking methodology. That's good to get. Okay, go on.
Yeah. Okay, so number 7, The East. I'm giving The East, or I gave it a 4 out of 5. We both saw this one. We just talked about it with Britt Marling. Pretty ambitious. Pulls off a lot of things really well. I think I gave it a higher ranking than you did. Not that you have to justify yourself, but I'll let you have the opportunity.
I liked it. I mean, it I'm trying to remember. Goodness great. I think I was probably less than 4 stars, but it was fun in that low key, ambitious, and not entirely successful indie way. I'm not disappointed to see it this high on your list.
Okay, good. So The East, 4 out of 5. Number 6 on the list, Iron Man. Now, this was the summer opener. I gave Iron Man a 4 out of 5. This is with Robert Downey Jr., if you've been under a rock and you didn't know that. It was a lot of fun, kind of gimmicky. Gwyneth Paltrow's in it. A lot of things, especially towards the end, that were just like so over the top. Plot points were off. I'm saying a lot of the negative, but Robert Downey Jr., he's a great actor, and when he's given the material that makes him shine, it makes for a really enjoyable movie. Really snappy, fast-paced dialogue. Really enjoyed it. It's summer popcorn movie. Did you end up seeing Iron Man?
No, that's one of the few that I haven't seen.
Okay, well, I'd mark it down as something to not miss. I mean, it's number 6 on my summer movie list of out of 10, so that's, you know, at the top of the second half.
I bet I could still find it in a theater around.
Maybe probably. It's still in, the proverbial dollar theaters and stuff like that. So, Okay, time for the first half, or the top 5. Are you ready?
Ooh, okay.
All right, number 5. This is the End.
Oh,
4 out
yes.
of 5. Now, for those who need a refresher, this was starring James Franco as himself with like a ton of other comedians. Really funny ensemble cast. Michael Cera was in it, which was, you feel like everyone in this movie is playing like an exaggerated, you know, make fun of them version of themselves. I really enjoyed the comedy here. It's got a little bit too much of the slapstick guy humor stuff that makes it less accessible. But then towards the end, it starts to drain you a little bit. It could have been 20 minutes shorter. But I was laughing a lot through this movie. I don't know about you.
I feel like I saw a ton of movies this summer, but that's yet another one, the third, I think, that I haven't seen on your list. I may have to go catch some of these up.
Yeah, okay, so number 5. So this is the End, 4 out of 5, it's number 5 on the list. Okay, number 4. Now, I know this one you've seen. Number 4 is Drinking Buddies.
Woohoo!
Yay!
That was a 5-star for me, obviously slightly less for you. Go back and see our mini-review if you want to hear us haggle.
Right. I liked it quite a bit, actually, being that it's, even though it's a 4 out of 5 only, it's still, you know, there's 3 other 4 out of 5 movies I just reviewed, or I just mentioned, that are below it. So it's number 4 on the list, really low-key indie dramedy, great performances by Olivia Wilde and Jake Johnson. Go see it.
Yeah, go see it.
Yeah. Number three on the list, Blue Jasmine. This is another one where we haggle. You can go back to the mini review of Blue Jasmine. I gave this one a 4 out of 5, and I liked it more than Logan did.
Yep, that's right. I didn't quite get it, and it made me feel uncomfortable, which I partly respect and partly was uncomfortable by.
Yeah, I hear you. It on those levels, it worked for me a lot better. I guess we don't need to rehash it, but Cate Blanchett does an excellent performance. I love Bobby Cannavale and some of the other ensemble cast. Love the story of seeing blue collar and white collar mix in economic themes. Woody Allen does a good job with this one. So that's number three on my list. Number two, Star Trek Into Darkness.
Star Trek, all right.
I gave this one a lot higher rating again than you did, 4.5 out of 5. I don't even know if it broke 4 for you.
I think it was 4, but I feel like I should give it a caveat. I criticize because I love. Huge Star Trek fan. This is the movie this summer that I'm sure I'll see in the future more than any other, just because I'm a huge Star Trek fan. It'll go in the canon. Anyway, so I'm not disappointed to see it there.
Nice, nice. So you support it being number 2 on the list.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, drum roll, please. Number one, The Way, Way Back.
Oh, yeah.
I guess, as it turns out, this is the only movie of the summer that I gave a solid 5 out of 5. Really quickly, I loved everything about this movie. I didn't find, although I respect the flaws you think you found...
That's really respectful, the way you put that.
Maybe not. I mean, off the cuff, that's... Yeah, so I loved everything about this movie. Great performances by Tony Collette and Steve Carell. I already forgot the kid's name, the actor who played out of nowhere, this teenager who's the center of this coming-of-age drama.
From The Killing, he does a decent job.
He's in The Killing.
I remember his name, yeah.
Cool. Sam Rockwell, I think, deserves an Oscar nod as supporting actor. I think he did a really good job as the local employer of the amusement park, water park that this coming-of-age character gets to confide in and gets to learn things from. Everything about this movie, the dialogue, the subject matter, the feel-good nature about it, but the realistic nature all wrapped up into one. This is the type of dramedy that I love to see. It is the movie of the summer for me. So that's my list. That's the top 10.
I liked The Way, Way Back, too. I feel like the fact that you gave that 5 and I gave it 4 is sort of the reverse of Drinking Buddies. For some reason, The Way, Way Back just went above and beyond and connected with you.
Yes.
Drinking Buddies did that for me. But I have nothing bad to say against The Way, Way Back. Just Drinking Buddies hit me a little bit more where it counts anyway. So I definitely approve of The Way, Way Back. If there were one movie that I've seen that you haven't that I'd be interested to see where it fits on your list, it would be In a World. I gave that 4 stars if I remember right.
Yeah. And I still want to see that one. It's just a limited release. Haven't gotten around to it. But I'm pretty sure from what the premise and your review, it's probably would be in the top half. We'll see, though, when I see it. I really, just to close off, I really like how you framed Drinking Buddies and The Way, Way Back. I think if we were to do a combined movie list, those would probably be the top 2 spots tied, basically. So if nothing else, if you want to get a stamp of approval from Bob and Logan for 2 movies, those are the 2 for the summer, I'd say.
Right on. Awesome. That's Bob's final summer power list rankings. All right. Now it's time for my final summer TV power rankings, my final list of the top 5 summer TV shows in ascending order. I'm going to go with 5. Summer's not the biggest time for TV, so I think 5 is about as many as we need to do. 5, Ray Donovan, 3 out of 5. So I've got 3 shows right at 3 stars for only 2 spots at the bottom of my top 5. Ray Donovan is going to be the one that sneaks on. I was excited to start off with Ray Donovan. The preview seemed cool. I think Liev Schreiber does a decent anti-hero, but that's sort of the thing, right? At this point, it gets a mediocre rating because the anti-hero thing is just so played out. We've had a lot of them lately, and we've had a lot of good ones too, so Ray Donovan would have to be great for me to like it more than my 3-star rating.
Yeah, I concur. In fact, I think 3 stars is fairly generous. We got a few episodes left, and unless it really pulls something off, this is... from my personal rating, I'm leaning towards more of a 2.5, giving it that extra half a star off to make a statement.
Yeah, we both agree it's sort of mediocre in any case, it looks like. So 4, The Newsroom. This is another 3-star show for me. It edges out Ray Donovan, though, because, well, it's the prototypical love it and hate it simultaneously kind of show that nets out Ray. Fall into some serious self-indulgent habits that can really, really bug the shit out of me. But any show that gives me a visceral reaction of any kind earns a modicum of respect for me, so it pulls in at number 4 in my summer rankings.
Okay, fair enough. I just my 2 cents is that I'm enjoying this one now, further along. I thought it was more mediocre or annoying me toward the beginning, but now I'm sort of get the nostalgic factors kicking in a little bit.
All right. Number 3, The Bridge, 3.5 stars. So The Bridge could end up a tick up or a tick down based on how the show ends, and we'll talk more about that in our recap later on. But I think its number 3 slot will probably stay about right, even if it ends really well or ends really poorly. Mm. I mean, I like the world it's created. I like a lot of the character interactions. It hasn't completely found its point of view or its direction yet, though. But it still has some good potential. Here's how I think of it. It has some good potential to be one of those shows that goes on to greatness where you tell people they have to get past the first season before it really picks up. That's not guaranteed, but I could see it maybe being one of those shows.
Yeah. I hope so, because it has a lot going for it, but you're absolutely right that it's kind of in this limbo land of it could go either way.
Yeah. Number 2, I know you'll disagree with this, Bob, but number 2 for me is Orange is the New Black, 4 out of 5 stars.
Wow, it's so high. Okay.
Well, I think that's what I gave it in my mini review, right?
Yeah.
It's the only show on this list we're not recapping, and I know you gave up on it, so I won't rehash it too much. You can check out my mini review from a few weeks back if you want, but it was just an unexpected delight for me. I didn't really get much advanced buzz. It came out, I heard about it, I watched it. It was one of those shows where I just enjoyed visiting the universe it created every episode. I liked checking in with the characters and learning more about them little by little and getting to know what makes them tick. And I liked it a lot.
Okay, now, did it feel pretty low stakes for you? Not that that makes or breaks whether or not it's a good show, but it felt part of what I've read also and why I sort of I'm happy with my decision to give up on it. It seems like there's a lot of flashbacks in every episode as a focus on, you know, some characters' backstory of why they're in jail, and that could be interesting, but it doesn't really stick with the series starts off with her being in jail and she's only there for a finite amount of time, and just the whole premise like seemed kind of it wasn't as interesting for me, but I guess for other people it's a lot more interesting, like for you.
Yeah, so about the flashbacks, I know flashbacks are a thing that you almost always hate. I agree that there can be very bad flashbacks, but I think there can be good flashbacks, too, and I think these ones actually did a good job of filling out the story about someone new every week just to help you understand their place in the prison ecosystem and how they got to be the way they are. Anyway, okay. I liked it.
Fair enough.
And we disagree about it, but on my rankings, they hit number 2.
Number one,
of course, Breaking Bad. It's one of the best shows on TV, the only great TV show on this summer. Whatever your thoughts on this last season, it's clearly the number 1 summer show, and I personally give it a 5 out of 5, and that gives it the number 1 spot.
Nice. I like how we're both consistently only giving a 5 out of 5 to our number 1s.
That's true. That's a good point. You didn't have to break that tie.
No.
Some shows I watched that didn't make the list.
Okay, Dexter, let's hear it.
Dexter, The Killing, True Blood, Arrested Development. I didn't even finish those last 3. So that's the list. That's the power rankings. Come back next week when we give our preseason fall winter power rankings to set the stage for the season.
Yeah, now I feel like we've already been watching a lot of TV, but it seems like the fall, just as a quick preview for next week, it's like even more TV in a good way, like a lot of good TV coming up, it feels like.
Yeah, well, fall is pretty much the main season for TV, so we'll have to figure out what we're going to recap and what we're not going to recap. Have to be more judicious probably than we were this summer.
Right. Whew. I'm excited.
All right. Let's get to some weekend picks, Bob. And we were just saying it's September, probably the biggest TV month of the year. and get ready because shows are coming fast and furious. This week alone, on Wednesday, we've got the duo If It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and The League returning. But take note, they're both not on FX now. They're on FXX, a new sister channel with double the X.
Yes, now I almost want to just pause and talk about that for a second. What's the deal with FX? I mean, I guess they're cool enough, branching out, creating two channels. It seems like with the extra X, it's for comedy specifically, and then their dramas are on FX. Is that the vibe I'm supposed to get?
Yeah, they've actually got another sister channel. They're splitting into three, and I'm blanking on the letters of the third one. But they're trying to just create like a portfolio of brands a little bit more. FX is actually really the place with probably every critic's favorite network head, John Landgraf. And they're doing a lot of really cool things. If you just, like the average FX show is just, if that's all you know about it, it probably says more about it than on any other network right now, except maybe HBO or something. Just doing a lot of really cool creative things. They have enough programming that they can branch out, and they want to target the brand of each one a little bit differently. So FXX is going to be probably mostly comedies. And that same vibe of The League, and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and it's not too hard to see how they share a branding.
Right, so. Yeah. And are they both on Wednesday, you said?
Yep, Wednesday, one right after the other.
I'm so excited. Those are both funny shows.
Yeah, so, you know, It's Always Sunny's a long-running comedy now about a group of friends who run a bar in Philadelphia. The way I always describe it is that these people might actually be the worst human beings on the planet. But it's still somehow charming and not mean-spirited because the joke's always on them at the end of every episode.
Right.
You watch Sunny, you've always mentioned. So you like it, yeah. I take it?
I do. No, you know, I actually haven't seen it start to finish every single episode, but I've probably seen, actually, maybe I shouldn't admit this, maybe only a third of them, because there's a lot of seasons. It's like six or seven seasons
it's
now.
Been going on for a while.
Right, and it's one of those shows that you don't really sit down and mark your calendar to, well, I will this season because now I'm more into it a little bit, but I sort of got into it after it's already been on for a while, and I just watch it here and there when I want some filler.
Yeah, it doesn't change much through the seasons.
No.
And the quality has remained pretty consistent, I would say.
Right.
So if you already watch it, this is the week it's back. Make sure your DVRs are set. If you don't watch it yet, you know, check it out. See if you like it. And there are a ton of past season to go through, like we were just saying.
Yeah.
The League, also, we mentioned, returning for its, fifth season. It's a show about friends who have a fantasy football league together. And it's very much of a piece, in my mind, with the Chicago set 30-something comedy of happy endings, which I had mixed feelings about. Mm. Got some dude bro humor, which you may or may not love. But I know you like the show a lot, right, Bob?
Especially the earlier seasons. I feel like it's getting a little tired. We'll see how this season performs. What is it, season 5? Because I felt like the last season 4, ended really, like the humor was really over the top stupid. But that's part of its shtick a little bit, but I feel like each season it tries to outdo itself from the last season, and I just want them to be like consistently funny, not trying to like pull a Breaking Bad of comedy, which is sort of backfiring for them a little bit, in my opinion.
You know, another FX show gets that perfectly somehow. Archer, it knows exactly what it is. It doesn't try to do more each season than the last. It just stays with the same range of jokes, and I feel like it just stays the same every season.
Cool. Yeah, so here's hoping The League follows that model, but I don't know. I'm still going to watch it, though, because there's enough about it that makes me laugh a lot. So
absolutely. We'll and then the last one I want to mention is Boardwalk Empire returns on Sunday. Now, we talked about Boardwalk Empire last week. You've given up on it. I'm half-heartedly trying to catch up. But it is a big-budget, high-profile HBO drama, so it's worth a mention here to remind you to set your DVR if you are a fan. But we're lukewarm about it, and I can tell you right now we won't be recapping it or anything. But it's on the list.
Yeah, this is one of those where if I didn't have a day job, I'd totally watch it. But since I do, I don't.
All right. Tell us about the movies, Bob.
Okay. So this is kind of a weak week, in my opinion, in terms of it's kind of this, we're entering the period in between the summer ending and the fall beginning. So the front runner, big budget Hollywood, only slot in that category is Riddick, which depending on how you feel about Vin Diesel and the whole premise of I can see in the dark and I talk like this, and you know, a lot
I've
of one-liners.
I've seen those previews like 3 weeks in a row at the movies now, and I don't know. I don't know if it's my kind of movie.
I'm not sure that it is either. You know, I kind of want to see it just because if you're in the mood and you suspend disbelief and you're okay with like a dark, gritty, over the top, taking itself too seriously, you know, action rated R movie. Yeah, it could be okay, but I'm not sure that that's going to be the one for this week for us to watch. We still need to figure that out. The other two on the radar for me, one is called Salinger. Now, this is one of those movies I have to admit that like gave me goosebumps almost just watching the previews. Like it seems very captivating. So it features interviews with 150 subjects, including Salinger's friends, colleagues, and members of his inner circle, and then a bunch of celebrities.
Right.
Yeah. About Salinger, who wrote the book Catcher in the Rye, and I guess had some really interesting backstory, and everyone talks about it. And I don't know much about, like, I guess if I was really into this type of literature, and it would be that much more fascinating. But just the previews alone, I'm like, whoa, based on a true story, and all these interviews, and it seems like a really interesting premise about what happened when he died, and what he really thought while he was writing these books. I don't know if I'm selling it very well. I'm just saying watch the preview and see if it captivates you like it did me.
Yeah, well, for me, documentaries may actually come in lower than British television as far as my default bias against them. Not to say I won't ever see one, but I'm like, documentary? But we'll figure it out. We'll decide what to see.
Okay, we may have a problem this week, Logan, because my third movie is also a documentary.
Uh-oh.
So we've got, like, Riddick or, you know, two documentaries to choose from. Or we could go back into the back catalog of stuff we didn't see from other weeks. We'll figure it out. This documentary is narrated by Russell Crowe. It's called Red Obsession, and it's a movie about wine and how it's changing. And it's as much about wine as it is about the rise of China and how China wants to be a formidable player in this space. And France is, you know...
where it's like Bottle Shock Revisited or something.
Yeah, and I liked the movie Bottle Shock. Yeah, it was good. So this is documentary, you know, France gets a ton of respect, and then there's California, which... is newer than France in terms of respect for wine, and now I guess China's on the rise, and it's looking into that. So
yeah, I don't know if I've ever had a Chinese wine.
Neither have I. Yeah, well, not that I know anyway. It could be one of those things where we don't know we had it. No, it seems really expensive to like import it and not say it. So anyway, those are the three movies of the week that caught my eye that are all releasing this week. I don't know if you saw anything else, and we can figure it out offline what we want to actually watch and review, but that's all there is for me.
No, but I did want to ask you about one movie, Bob, and that is The Butler. Now, I'm going to admit something I probably should be ashamed of, but it's that I get the sense it's a very heavy movie that takes itself very seriously, and I feel exhausted just even thinking about seeing it, even though I feel like if I were a good person... that wouldn't be the case. Now, I could be completely wrong about that, I admit, but my question is this, Bob. Is this going to get Oscar buzz to the point where we'll wish we'd seen it just so we can weigh in on Oscar nominations and the like?
Yeah, I'm hoping it comes out on DVD before then, because I just don't feel like spending full price for the ticket. Maybe if it goes to the Dollar Theater, I'll do it then, but I'm right there with you. I know it's supposed to be a monumental picture about race and... about race, like what else is there to say? It's kind of one of those movies you wish you had seen already without having to have gone through the effort of seeing it, so you can like be plugged in. But otherwise, I'm already exhausted talking about it this much. So
exactly.
We'll see if we end up having to watch it.
All right. So I think we'll have to figure out look for a Twitter or Facebook blast, or at least come to our website where it will definitely be up which movie we decide for a full review.
Absolutely.
That's what you got for this week. It's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. Go forth and watch. All right, Bob. Breaking Bad. It's time to get to Breaking Bad. And again, we love you, everyone who listens to our full podcast every week. We love you, everyone who watches on YouTube. And we also give a special welcome to listeners of our new mini-podcast, Practically Culture Breaking Bad, which you can find as its own feed on iTunes and on practicallyculture.com. Okay, Bob. This is the first episode of the summer that's left me scratching my head a little, I got to admit. So the show apparently is showing its hand a little, setting up the final showdown as being between Walt and Jesse, it seems like, or at least suggesting that. And there's something really cool about that, something inevitable, or inevitable, something very fitting. But I feel like we had an uncharacteristically clunky episode this week to set it up.
Yeah. Now, if others who have seen the previous recap, the episode before this one, you'll note that I was like Logan is for this one. I feel like I caught on to the show being a little clunky about an episode ago, and I guess I have to be careful how I phrase this, because it's still really enjoyable and good in a lot of ways, but I totally agree with you. This episode sort of carried through that clunkiness that I started to catch on last episode, where things need to be wrapped up, and it's just not quite as smooth in how things come together. A lot of really coincidental timing and things that are just happening because it's tightening itself up for the ending.
Yeah, so what bothered me most, I think, is we see Walt trying to act like he has principles again. You know, a couple episodes ago, he refused to off Hank, and in this episode, Jesse is like a rabid dog that both Skyler and Saul think should go, but Walt doesn't want to do what everyone knows he should.
Right.
And it's not like Walt's having a little compassion when it makes no difference to him, because Walt's not 100% evil all the time, you know. So he'll do things that are nice to people he likes if it doesn't hurt him. But Jesse does seem like he could hurt him. You know, these are not him being smart in a way that will benefit him. That's not the Heisenberg we've been getting for 5 seasons now. He would have offed Hank and Jesse, no questions asked. And so I'm not so sure that it makes sense to me, his hesitation here.
Well, I think the show is trying really hard to put Jesse in a box in terms of Walt's approach towards him. And I get that. Like, he's done a lot for Jesse. They've been through this together, through the whole thing from the beginning. But you're right that, like, at this phase of Heisenberg-esque behavior, maybe it would have been too heavy-handed for them to point it out for me, but I'm not quite getting why Jesse is still off-limits. It feels like Hank is more off-limits than Jesse, but the show's almost trying to make a statement that Jesse's even more off-limits than Hank.
Yeah, and actually, to be honest, with Hank, I buy it a little bit more just because Walt had a good plan without killing him. You know, as Marie says to her therapist, Walt basically won. He dominated Hank into submission. And if that plan doesn't work, it's not because Walt didn't come up with a great plan, because he did. With Jesse, though, you know, Hank even mentions to Jesse while they're at the table that it looks like Walt has always had a soft spot for you, Jesse. And that immediately made me start thinking in my mind, has he? Has he had a soft spot for Jesse? Or has it always been that he's needed Jesse, or that he's found it valuable to keep Jesse around, or at certain times needed an ally, and Jesse could have been that only person? Because he's also jerked Jesse around and been a real dick to Jesse, too.
Yeah, and this is kind of a weird father figure type thing, too, with Walt, because with his own son, he hasn't been able to have that father relationship in the way that maybe he wanted, just because he's been holding so much back and he's lying to him as much as he's telling him anything that's the truth through all 5 seasons. So I think there's an interesting comparison to be made between Jesse and Walt Jr. in terms mm-hmm. of how Walt is treating them both like his son, but only one of them really is. But it feels like Heisenberg has lost it to the point where it's almost uncharacteristic. Without beating over the head, I still don't quite get why Jesse's now off limits. And we see that where Walt's on the park bench in the very public space, and this is one of those coincidences that kind of drove me nuts this episode. Jesse is wearing a wire and is going to go talk to Walt, but then decides not to because he sees like a seventh bald guy that looks shady. But then later on we see that the daughter of this bald guy runs up to him and, oh, it's just a coincidence that there is a guy that's perfectly placed to be somebody that looks suspicious, and the show's trying to say, like, Jesse was thinking Walt was already wanting to take him out, but it's just this huge misunderstanding because Walt really still did have a soft spot at that stage.
Yeah, except you're right, he does seem to have a soft spot at that stage. But then if we grant the idea that Walt has that soft spot, at the end he calls Todd, and it's suggested that what he's going to ask Todd to do is off Jesse, And if that's the case, he seems to be able to switch into that mode without much soul searching. You know what I mean? So, oh,
right.
Okay. Well, I guess we do have to kill Jesse.
Yeah, and I guess in defense of the show, that flip of a approach, like, it'd be really hard to show on screen because it's really a struggle with himself. I don't know how they could have progressively shown it, but it did seem like for five seasons of up until that moment, Walt going out of his way to risk everything for Jesse, and then it's just like, ah, I guess it's not going to work. Let me whip out my cell phone. Todd, hey, I got another job. I'm like, really?
Yeah. So, you know, even though I'm not sure about all that stuff with Walt, though, I did like Jesse's storyline. It makes sense for Jesse to be how Jesse is. And I love when he's at Hank's table saying how, you know, Walt is smarter than you guys, and he's also luckier than your guys. He's basically the devil. You know, because Jesse's like the guy in the whole world who knows the Heisenberg version of Walt better than anyone else alive. And he automatically doesn't trust Walt.
Yeah. In an alternate reality, can I just say that I almost wish that I could see another episode where Jesse actually sits down on the park bench and we see Walt trying to manipulate him and Jesse struggling with wearing a wire and then Walt's story. Because if you think about what Walt did to Brock, which is what fueled Jesse's rage in this last episode or two, it's not nearly as bad, in my opinion, as what Walt did to Jesse's girlfriend several seasons ago. And I think that Walt could smooth talk his way out of it because it was deliberately calculated in a way that would not harm Brock permanently, even though it was a huge deal. I feel like that manipulation conversation would have been more interesting than Jesse just... Than the misunderstanding that the show set up, because the show's almost like showing them pass in the night, like, oh, they're so close to resolving it, but nope, it's too late. They have to go after each other. It's a showdown.
That would be a really interesting scene to see. But, you know, when Jesse decides to turn away, part of me is excited about that too, because for as smart as Walt is, Jesse showed himself to be pretty smart at certain times. Like, magnets was his idea, right, for example?
Yeah, that's true.
So when something clicks for him, he's shown a spark of genius at times, and he also knows Walt better than anyone else. I actually believe it, and I'm quite eager to hear what his plan is to get Walt where he lives.
Yeah. We're toward the end, and now it's just like, oh, how is this all going to come together?
So, you know, a few other things that I want your take on. One thing I loved was the way Walt's chickens are coming home to roost, though. Not a single person believes a word out of his mouth. For we have Jesse, who's like, if Walt says this, I don't believe him. The exact opposite is going to happen is what Jesse thinks if Hank says, or if Walt says something. We've also got his ridiculous pump malfunction story. Skyler doesn't buy it, and Flynn doesn't buy it either. It's like, yeah. We assume you're lying to us, and this is what's happening to Walt after he's sowing what he's reaped. He's
in
reaping
fact,
what he's sown.
Yeah. In fact, Flynn's story that he thinks is the reality of what happened would have been a great cover. It's like more believable than...
Right.
You just passed out again. It's the cancer coming back. And Walt was quick to not admit that because he wants to still be a strong father, I guess, but still play into it a little bit. Well, I did get a little woozy, but I didn't pass out.
Yeah. So that's what it's like to be Walt now. He's made it so no one believes him.
Right.
What else? Oh, yeah. So does Hank not have any problems going quasi-official with his Walt investigation now? He's got Steve Gomez on board, and they're using DEA equipment. But I thought he's basically been forbidden to pursue this officially. But
no.
It looks
no.
like it's getting pretty official.
I don't think it's official at all. I think what he did is he called in a favor to Steve and said, come to my house. I can't talk about it. It has to be off the record. Because he did talk to his wife and basically said, I can't do anything. I can't take Jesse to a safe house. I can't put him in the system because Walt is going to get that right away. So I think he just trusts Steve Gomez. And now Gomez is in this with him, and it's totally off the record, and it's just the one person he's confiding in. That's how I read it.
So I guess we'll just assume they did their own sting operation to get, like, the official equipment and the wire and the video camera and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's all off the record, and they're going out on a limb. Both Steve, they're just really, Steve and Hank are really hoping this pays off because they're in big doo-doo if they get caught for doing this on the side and it doesn't amount to anything, right?
And they've mentioned that they don't have a guarantee that it will lead to anything, just like Jesse warned them.
Yep.
So I got another question for you. Since you're on the record about hating flashbacks, did you like the sort of Flash parallel where we saw the scene with Hank walking in on Jesse after we saw with how Walt dealt with his interpretation of Jesse going to his house?
Actually, I really liked this. If anything, this aspect of the episode, I think it was a great storytelling device. I was very curious through the first time when Walt was walking through trying to dissect the scene and figure it out on his own, and then we get to see the show re-show it from a different mm-hmm. angle. Really enjoy that. Since we're on this topic, I want to say, though, this episode made me made me dislike the flashbacks that I was previously only okay with, made me dislike them a lot, because I feel like now that we're getting towards the end, there would have been a lot more suspense if I didn't already know some of how the ending is coming together because of those flashbacks. So, disappointed.
Because the house doesn't have fire damage and stuff like that.
Right, right. Yeah, disappointed on how the flashbacks are ruining some of the suspense and the what's next for me.
The flash forwards, you mean?
Yeah, the flash forwards. The flash forwards. They're becoming more and more of a pain in my side in terms of storytelling. but this flash parallel, for lack of a better term, I thought it was done really well. What did you think?
I think I liked it. I was actually having a reaction that reminded me of you when I realized, oh, we're going to have a flash parallel here. But it turned out to be unexpected, but it made a lot of sense that Hank would be following him, even though that's the last thing I was expecting, to see Hank come in and be the one who stopped it.
Right.
So I liked it. I thought it was effective.
Cool.
Any final words before we move on, Bob?
Yeah, let's talk about Skyler for a second. When they're in the hotel room, she basically orders a hit on Jesse before Walt, and I guess this is the show's way, if it were to defend itself in this episode, of having Walt change his mind, both him and Saul, with his colorful metaphors, old Yeller, both of them basically tell Walt what he needs to hear. Dude, you've done so much. Like, Jesse is just collateral damage, and he's nothing compared to what you've already done. But I'm surprised. Skylar was shaking a little bit. She had some lip quivering, and she didn't like that she had to point this out. But I guess we're seeing Mrs. Heisenberg show through in the sense that she's now comfortable with the slippery slope being what it is. I was thinking maybe that she was still at odds with Walt in terms of her morality being still at a different level than his, but it feels like she's almost there with him at this stage. What did you think?
I actually look at it a little bit differently. I thought that when Jesse's coming to their home, putting gasoline everywhere, almost burning it up, we know that he's super pissed at Walt. This guy is a loose end at this point. He's out of control. He can't be managed. Saul and Skyler have it exactly right. If you are this deep, you have to go all the way. Why stop here, as Skyler puts it? We've broken all these laws, all these morals, all these principles, across all these lines. It makes absolutely no sense to be this arbitrary principle, the one that keeps us from seeing this thing through. I feel like it's so obvious that I had a problem with Walt not seeing how obvious it was, sort of the other way. So you're right, that Skyler wasn't exactly comfortable saying that. She hated that she had to be the one to say it, but it's just so obvious that even Skyler knew it.
Right, so you're saying this just reinforced the whole scene with Walt on the park bench being sincere felt almost a little out of place.
To me, that's the case.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, how about you? Last word?
Yeah, so to wrap up, I'll say it one more time. As Jesse's been withering away, I haven't really figured he'd be a big part of the end, but I'm excited now at how inevitable it seems and how proper it'll be for there to be a Jesse-Walt showdown. And let's just hope that the ham-fisted story hiccups in this episode are behind us and we can get back some of our momentum now that the chessboard has been rearranged.
Love it. Awesome.
Only four more episodes.
Can't wait.
All right, Bob. The Bridge episode called The Vendetta, or Vendetta. Okay, now we're getting somewhere, Bob, with The Bridge.
Yeah.
So we find out, if I have this right, that where to begin? Our bad guy is David Tate, who shows up out of nowhere, but not out of nowhere, but not someone I expected. He's an FBI agent who faked his suicide several years ago. He assumed the identity of Kenneth Hastings, who he apparently killed and ditched the body. he stole some writings from Jack Childress, the crazy suspect from last week, and has been using those to give a political tinge to his crazy plot. But it looks like his plan is really about revenge. See, 6 years ago, this guy, Santee Jr., was partying with Daniel Fry, of all people. He runs out of drugs at a strip club, drives off to get more, and he hits and kills Tate's wife, who was on her way home from sleeping with none other than our pal Marco. And Tate, in this episode, got revenge on Santee Jr., we see, and he apparently has started his revenge on Marco by boning Marco's wife.
Yes. Wow. So this was the episode that was the reveal of how all the pieces on the board are playing with each other, even though we because up until now we had been seeing them sort of as isolated stories. There might still be an isolated story or two, but I feel like everyone's connected at this stage.
I feel like maybe Stephen Linder, we don't quite fully see his connection yet.
Yeah, yeah. Or the tunnel. I don't know exactly how that plays in completely with this wider revenge plot, but whatever. We're seeing enough that I can sort of decide how I feel about what the statements are and the motivations. And I have to say I'm a little disappointed that it's less to do with political statements and more to do with revenge. And there are some plot holes that I almost want to go back and rewatch certain episodes to see if they actually tie into the behavior that somebody who's seeking revenge would go for versus somebody who's faking a political statement. And I don't know. It just feels like all those people dying in the desert, the picking up the girl who and then putting her out in the sun, like that's a lot of on-the-fly stuff for a guy who's doing revenge stuff, right?
Yeah, you're right. And so I'll agree. I was going to ask you how the revelation changed how you might feel about the show, and you sort of explained now. And I'm pretty much right along with you there. It's mixed because I like that we have some more direction to the main plot, but at the same time, it's almost a cop-out of a reveal because, as you mentioned, the political statement seems to have been a fake-out, but that's a lot of effort to go for a fake-out, and it's just a mastermind killer who enjoys killing and is trying the very long game, the long con of revenge. So I'm worried, we'll have to see how it plays out, but I'm worried that some of the potential that the show has of creating a rich world with cool characters might have been squandered. Hoping not. We have like four or five episodes left to really wrap this up. It could go well or it could go not so well.
Yeah, and I also feel like the show sort of painted itself into a corner because this is a pretty self-contained story. Like, there's going to be a showdown, I suspect, or, you know, an interaction between all of these characters that have so much exposé, and they're part of this season because they're so pivotal to this killer's master plan of getting revenge on everyone in just the right way. But once that's resolved, everyone that we're seeing has come together, and maybe this isn't the most important thing to point out, but I just find it fascinating. Part of my brain was like, how the hell are they going to make a season two out of this show? It's just like impossible.
No, you're absolutely right. We were reminded in this episode that Marco isn't really an El Paso cop. His boss is the Juarez guy, and if they don't have this killer they're going after, Marco isn't going to have the justification for being embedded with the El Paso crew.
Yeah, and same with Daniel Fry. Like, he's part of the story because of this particular case. There's just a lot going on that just would be too many coincidences to keep this same cast of characters running through beyond this storyline. But that said, I guess we should get back to this particular story. it's still got a few episodes, and it ends with him, not to jump ahead too much, but it ends with our killer friend driving off with his newfound lover, and it's you're dying to know what happens, and it almost feels like it should be like one episode away from the end, but it's like four or five. That's crazy.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know what his plan for revenge is because, you know, on one hand, he's killed the guy who killed his wife, and he's already had sex with the guy's wife who had sex with his wife. So that could be, hypothetically, the end of the revenge. But he might want to take Marco's wife from her like he lost his wife, too. And so that's why you just don't know what's going to happen, and it could be pretty scary.
Yeah, yeah.
But is it really possible that Alma, Marco's wife, had this relationship with this guy and Marco never saw him? Because he knows the guy. He would recognize him instantly if he saw him.
Yeah, it seemed very risky for him to have this relationship with Alma and not have that ruin his plan that he's apparently been planning for years and years. Oh, that's the other thing. Just side note. There was an episode way back when where they made a big point of how the recording was done by a guy who was hired years and years ago. And I wanted to double check if that was congruent with this guy's going crazy and his wife dying. Has it been enough years that he actually has been planning this from years ago and it was maybe just after his wife died and it's all part of the long game? Did that all add up to you, or if you maybe you're like me and you didn't, like, you know?
Yeah, well, if we can just talk out of our asses about this without having looked it up. So they showed us the first thing was 6 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And so it's, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. It was like 5 or almost 6 years ago when he started this long scheme. For some reason, I thought that guy who was hired for the recording was like 3 years ago, but I'm just sort of pulling that out of the air. I might be wrong.
Oh, okay. Maybe you're right. Maybe it was
still long enough ago that you're like, holy shit, that's a long time ago, but it could be a long time ago, and this could still be even longer ago.
Right, and how convenient that Marco had an affair in just the right time for Alma to want to have an affair with, you know, a balding, boring-looking guy or whatever.
Yeah. Like, because that affair still seems like the most boring affair ever.
Yeah.
Like, you really want this, right? Oh, I want it. Do you want it?
Yeah, that's a buzzkill. That's when, you know, the drive kind of leaves the room.
Right, I would think, of all the downsides to having an affair, the fact that it would be really exciting would be the upside, right?
You'd
but
think,
that doesn't
yeah.
seem to be the case for them.
Right.
So what about the step-by-step process of getting to the big reveal, Bob? So, you know, they've got Childress, and Sonya just doesn't think he did it. And then she finds all the stuff pointing to a Fed, David Tate, who looks like he could have done it, but Marco's like, hey, Sonya, he's dead. But that doesn't stop her. She's like, no, it's still going to be possible because they don't investigate suicides in Juarez. No one believes her. She pretty much gets the hang of the DEA treatment, like, Sonya, stop looking at this. But she keeps on it. She finally finds out that David Tate has stolen the identity of a dead guy they found. Is Sonya's genius believable to you?
I'm teetering on the fence on this one because on the one hand, it drives the story forward. Somebody has to be the dogged, persistent, detective-like person. But on the other hand, she's so oblivious to so many other things, it's hard for me to reconcile that. It's almost analogous to Monk.
But Monk is like comedy-based, right? It's not supposed to be 100% believable.
Yeah, no, it's not. But in the same way that Monk's character is obsessive-compulsive, and there's so many episodes for any Monk fans out there, sorry. I mean, I like Monk a lot, too, actually. I've seen a lot of it. There's so many episodes where, and by the way, the guy who plays the DEA lead, older guy, what's his name? The main character, sorry.
In The Bridge?
Yeah, that we were just talking about.
The DEA lead?
Not DEA, just the older detective.
Ted Levine.
Ted Levine, yeah. He's like the main guy that always has to give Monk a hard time, so maybe that's the connection I'm making. Sorry for taking forever to come to that, but because Ted Levine plays a similar role in both shows. But and there's so many episodes in Monk where it's like, drop it. Hey, there's no connection. You're making too much of a leap here. And then like the episode ends with like, oh my gosh, he was right. Wow, we should believe him every time. And then the next episode, it's like, drop it. You're making too much of a. And I feel like Sonya's already proven herself a couple of times, followed by a couple of drop its. And that's a too long of a segment to explain how. No, it's not that believable because they should give her more credit at this point or give her no credit at all, but it's
hard.
Yeah,
for me what's weird is that we're just supposed to believe that this woman who's quirky and odd and weird and doesn't get people, because of that she has got this other mystical ability to just know things. Because it doesn't really show us step by step as well as I'd like how she puts these connections together. We just have to believe that she does.
Right, yeah, it's believable because it's stuffed down our throat, not because we're figuring it out ourselves that it's believable.
Right. So Gus is making a clear move, a play for Sonya now, and they have an interesting conversation, right? Did I get this right? To me, Sonya seems to be saying not that she doesn't like Gus. What she's saying is she doesn't feel like she knows how to be in a relationship and give people what she wants, which almost like leaves a hypothetical door open for Gus.
Right. Well, there were a lot of things in that scene that were almost out of character for Sonya. Number one is she was very self-aware, and both admitting that she's not good with people, also admitting that Gus's father wouldn't like it, and then she also asked his age, I think, like, was there an age question, or like it felt like she was almost wanting to understand, or maybe I just asked that question.
I can't remember.
It just seems like she was very meticulous in her approach with Gus, and she is leaving the door open, but she's also nervous about it and thinking it through a lot for the person she is. I'm not sure if that's how I would have seen her doing it, but whatever.
Yeah. So... anyway, that was an interesting conversation. I sort of like how it didn't wrap things up in a neat little bow. I actually like that.
Yeah.
One of the other many storylines, Ray's friend, who we know is an FBI snitch, shows up with an ice cream truck, and Ray drags the guns through the tunnel. He seems disappointed not to have to seal the deal again.
Yeah.
But Charlotte finds out about the scheme to run guns, and she isn't happy. And then Graciela finds some transmitters with the guns, which actually seems like sloppy FBI work if they're trying to mess up. Like, they're probably trying to mess up Ray, I suppose, not trying to do anything about getting the guns to Mexico, so they're probably happy with the Mexicans finding out that he's snitching on them.
I guess, yeah, this is one of those side plots that's interesting as a premise, but isn't getting enough expose to really explain itself, because I already made the call that Ray is a goner pretty soon anyway.
That's right.
But I'm not sure if I think the stronger story is Graciela and the FBI going after her. But if it's all about Ray and we don't know his past, then the sloppy work would be justified. But it's not enough expose to know which way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, a little confused about that. Oh, Alma's pregnant, but it's got to be Marcos, right? Because she's only boned her new guy recently.
And yeah.
She couldn't know she's pregnant that soon, right?
Right, that's what I gather too. Yep.
Okay. The last thing I have is it was fun to see Hank not being gringoed by the Mexican chief who's insulting him, and he talks back in Spanish. Way to jujitsu the assumption that no American speaks Spanish.
I like that too. That was pretty cool.
Any final thoughts on the bridge, Bob?
Oh, I've come this far. It's rough around the edges. I have my issues, but it's enjoyable, and I'm glad we're watching it and recapping it. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the new reveal brought some needed direction to the show, but it wasn't as impactful as I hoped. We're moving into the end game now, and I'm in on the show enough to watch it to the end, but a lot will depend on how they stick the landing in terms of me deciding whether I'll watch after this season.
Yep, me too.
And that is this week's episode of Practically Culture. Find us at practicallyculture.com, catch our new YouTube channel where you can see video clips of this episode, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Logan Bow, Bob's at Bob Caswell. Leave us a comment, send us a tweet, let us know how you like the podcast. Get out there and watch some TV and movies, people. It's good for you. Thanks for rocking with us.
Have a good one.
In the field of